Okie dokie, indeed.
Hello everyone, my name is Raven Goff. I have also forgotten to put in an intro slide or any information about myself whatsoever. I am qualified as a photographer, and that's about it. I have a degree in photography. This talk is mainly built from personal experience that then kind of sparked my curiosity and sent me down many Wikipedia rabbit holes. And based on the experiences that I've heard of others as well, and some books that I bought to fill it in. So this talk is called Wandering Wombs, A History of Medical Misogyny. It's all about how, well, gender discrimination with doctors and how that's been really informed by some shitty ideas from about 5,000 years ago. It still persists to this day. So yeah, content warning, this presentation will include references to gendered biological functions because this is within the framework of misogyny. So it's generally in what the most common occurrence of interactions is between patients and doctors. We have talked about medical malpractice, medical abuse, mental health, and sexuality. So, medical misogyny, what is it? Is it when surveyed? Recently is what I had in my notes, didn't put a date. 81% of female patients felt that they had experienced gender discrimination when interacting with a doctor. This came from both male and female doctors, and this is because it's baked into the system. The men wrote the books 100 years ago, and the students were men, and they're the ones who teach the women. It's just this long chain, and it just takes cycles and cycles and cycles to be able to scrape this ill thought out of the system. Symptoms are essentially taken less seriously. So if you're in pain as a woman, it's taken less seriously because men have a higher pain tolerance, apparently. So if a man goes in and says he's in pain, then he's taken seriously because, oh God, he must be really in pain if he's complaining about it. Women are also viewed as unreliable narrators of their experiences. I recently read a story about someone who went to the doctor with appendicitis, and the doctor said that she had an ovarian cyst. And she said, no, that can't be true because I've had my ovaries removed. And she saw three different doctors who all insisted that she had an ovarian cyst until finally they looked at her medical history and realized that that was true. This also applies to mental health, it applies to neurodivergence, and applies to trans patients as well. And we also have this lovely little acronym at the bottom, which was, this is translated from Swedish, but it was found on a lot of patients' notes. Basically translates to bitch with a lot of symptoms that they would write on their patients to let the other doctors know that these were difficult patients that needed to be treated in a particular way. It's also the problem. It really comes down to the uterus, as far as doctors are concerned. It's been seen as a source of women's issues, like I said, for over 5,000 years. Hysteria was the term that was coined by it. We still use that kind of phrasing today. So we have hysterectomies. You can be hysterical. That can both be a good thing because it means you're really funny, or a bad thing because you're acting very emotionally unstable. It was thought at the time that the womb would actually wander around the body and cause mischief and bite on other organs and cause problems. So it's a very ubiquitous organ. The uterus. First accounts, those being uncontrollable emotions, unruliness, loss of appetite both for food and sex, or too much appetite for food and sex. Can't win. These have been recorded, yeah, since 1900 BC. Up until about the 4th and 5th century, this idea of a wandering womb kind of fell out of fashion, but up until that point, it was noted that hysteria occurred most often in the childless and the unmarried. Basically, they theorized that if the womb remained unused and empty for too long after puberty, then it would get bored. That's when it would go off and rebel and start wandering around. So we need to do a wedding and a bedding, get that uterus to good work. And through that, then hopefully we kind of rein in these difficult symptoms. If that didn't work, then you had some very interesting treatments. One pictured here, where they would kind of waft pleasant scents at the entrance to lure the uterus back into place. I've often wondered which scents. Anyone with a uterus here has any idea what scents the uterus might enjoy? And of course, this is an issue that never really went away. It just keeps having its name changed. So throughout the medieval areas and through kind of like the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, we start to look at things like demonic possession and witchcraft and the witch hunts. Obviously, any time that a woman is disobedient, doesn't want to be married, you can imagine that lesbianism gets featured into this a lot. It was very much seen as a moral issue. It was an issue of the soul, of constitution. And so women were very harshly punished for being anything other than an obedient wife and mother. Moving into modern medicine then, it tries to be a bit less vibes-based. So they don't just come up with ideas and go, well, I'm a doctor, and so therefore what I say works. No, they tested, they experimented. They decided to try and find out what does work, what doesn't. They didn't. they treated women as kind of like the ideal thing to experiment on because they were at home. This is as capitalism is coming in and really taking force. You don't really want to experiment on men of working age because they're the productivity creators. So women who were staying at home was seen as like the ideal. Doctors would come in and just spend all day poking them with sticks, stealing their blood, performing unwanted surgeries on them. And we bring hysteria back into medical literature now. Starting to get put down as a genuine condition. And also finally we get some gender equality in this as we include men under the diagnosis of hysteria. Except this was usually for men who showed signs of effeminence or deviance or homosexuality. So we're starting to pathologize queerness now. Like, basically these people are bored and they're looking at humans and they're going, these people are actually a bit different. That's a bit strange. We need to start corralling them in boxes and in symptom lists. Lots of people were institutionalized during this time. And again, experimented on, tried to beat it out of them. Electroshock therapy and lobotomies persisted until the 1950s in America for queer people. Then we get the introduction of psychiatry as they start to look at the brain then instead of the uterus as a possible source of all these issues. Obviously, a lot of these physical treatments that they try to do to keep women in check aren't really working. So they start to try and unpick the psyche of women. Now they're viewing these physical symptoms that women are having. They're very unhappy, so not too surprising. It's seen as psychosomatic, so created by the brain with no other cause. You end up with these really strange lists of so many vague symptoms that you could basically like take any condition and look at the symptoms list and it would fit under hysteria. But that just kind of depends on the attitude of the patient on whether they get diagnosed properly with a condition or whether they get diagnosed with hysteria. And yeah, how do we define a medical condition anyway? Medicine loves a universal solution. They like to be able to say, this is the thing that works and just apply it to an entire population base. Humans are a bit more complicated than that. We come in lots of different shapes and sizes. We come from different places. We have different genetics. We have different endocrine systems. The idea of like what a normal healthy body is largely an arbitrary concept. Someone just decided what it was at one point and we're still kind of clinging on to that idea of what normal was. We haven't really moved on. And of course, when in doubt, you can just blame the patient for not complying, for doing unhealthy things. You can start bringing that morality back into it and start blaming lifestyle choices. And so what about the transes then? So how do trans people feature into it? Because we're coming into the late 19th century, early 20th century. These things start to become much more spoken about, much more pronounced in society. So here we have like the first okay dude in this talk, Magnus Hirschfeld, born in 1968. First medical professional to say perhaps we should stop beating gay people to death. It's just like a fun activity. He very much lobbied governments to allow same-sex relations. He created like a doctor's fit check notes for transvestites to be able to dress femininely in public without being accosted by police. Because back then in Germany, you had to have an ID card that had your legal gender on there. So if you were dressed as a woman, but it said male, then you got beaten by the police. He gave like a prescription note that said like, no, it's okay. You can do that. allowed them to change their name only to a gender neutral name. You couldn't change your name to a female name. It had to be a gender neutral one. But it's a step. You know, we're coming from difficult places here. And obviously, you know, we pioneered some of the first male to female sexual reassignment surgeries. Cool dude. Until the Nazis come along. Magnus Hirschfeld was a Jew and he was homosexual. And so, yeah, literally 1984, remembering my own jokes. So this is one of the first places in 1933 that the Nazis decided to attack. I mean, this wasn't like an organized effort by the party. This was just from like a social group of people who got together to say how much they hated disabled people and gay people and Jewish people. And they thought they'd have some fun. Died 2 years after this. And so, yeah, these books that are being burnt. And this is an image that often gets brought up when people want to complain about the left and saying that we're trying to ban things and we're trying to ban information. Though the Nazis were the first ones to do it, and they specifically targeted queer scientific research and the truth about queer identities when they did so. But you can't stop a tramp with a plan, as we found earlier from Abby's talk. So in the UK, the way it worked is that you could secure hormone treatment from about two endocrinologists in Harley Street. This is kind of in the 1950s, 1960s. And there were some surgeons you could go to, the most common one being a surgeon in Morocco and Casablanca. So it used to be called going to Casablanca would be a euphemism for transitioning. And it was also seen as an intersex condition by these endocrinologists. That's why they were treating it so kind of affirmedly. So you would go get your treatments, you would then go to the doctor and say, hi, actually, I'm intersex, you've made a mistake. You'd be issued with a new birth certificate that would allow you to change all your documents. Everything would be fine. Nice. Just little. This got a little bit darker, but so I thought I'd throw in a nice fun image of this photoshopped trans woman in the 50s hanging out. But just to say, like, yeah, we have always been around, and this has been going on for a long time. It'd be nice if we could make some good progress. So endocrinology versus psychiatry then. So while the endocrinologists in the UK were actually quite based, American psychiatrists were a bit different. In the 50s, like I said, they're still being institutionalized, still being lobotomized. In the 60s then, the journals start, the people who are writing the medical journals, they start meeting up and they start arguing and they start debating about what the best approach on how to deal with these troublesome patients is. Psychiatrists believe that they should be able to convince trans people out of their condition. Endocrinologists just think, oh, it's just a quirk of birth, it's a developmental disorder, we just need to treat them with medicine and then they're happy. The psychiatrist won, unfortunately. So transness was viewed as a mental disorder, needed to be corrected, and saved gender-affirming care then for the most troublesome patients, the ones who really, really were adamant about their condition. Then we come up to the curious case of April Ashley in the UK. This is stuff that's kind of only recently started to come to light. She began transitioning in Paris in the 50s. She had her surgery in 1960 in Casablanca. Was a very successful model and actress. She was publicly outed then in the papers. A friend sold her story to the Sunday Express at the time. And so it became it was a really long drawn out scandal. Like, her movie credit was removed because of it. And at some point she married a baron, so a member of the aristocracy. And he knew about her past. He knew that she was a trans woman, but he decided that they wanted to break the marriage up in 1963. I'm gonna guess he was getting some negative attention from his mates. That's usually the case in all of this. She filed for maintenance payments, and he didn't want to give any money because he's rich and rich people like to keep all the money that they have. So he decided to try and annul the marriage on the basis that she was a man legally, and therefore, because gay marriage is illegal, the marriage certificate wasn't valid. And the annulment was granted in 1970. This ended trans rights as they existed in the UK. They determined and set precedents that trans people weren't intersex and that they couldn't change their legal gender on their birth certificates. During the case, Ibarashi was essentially subjected to humiliating and degrading medical examinations to prove that she was assigned male at birth and not intersex. And they cited the medical literature in the court case to determine that it was a condition of the mind and not developmentally. And they used a lot of these medical journals that were being published in America to bring over here. It's always this back and forth between America and the UK as well. But yeah, because of the psychiatrist doing that thing in America, that really messed up our ability to do anything in this country. And then we end up with a man called Harry Benjamin, a controversial figure in trans history. You briefly did work at the Institute of Sexology with Magnus Hirschfeld. He traveled to the States in the 50s, and he started to work with trans patients kind of as an intermediary between what the endocrinologists in the UK were doing and what the American psychiatrists were doing. He was essentially asked to come to the States, to San Francisco, because a psychiatrist had an interesting case of a mother with a child, and the child was born assigned male at birth, but insisted that she was a girl. And the mother, interestingly, didn't want this beaten out of her child. She actually wanted to get it affirmed. And so they brought in Harry Benjamin into that case to advise on the best way to do this. And he gave the child estrogen, and this seemed to calm the child. So yeah, he started working then, and he started documenting the people he's working with. He's the first person to coin transsexual, as opposed to Hirschfeld, who coined transvestite years before. He pioneered the hormone replacement therapy treatments. Not necessarily that we use today, we've moved on from a lot of them, but he was the only person to really start to document what a treatment plan could look like. And he created the first standards of care as part of the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association, now much more simply known as WPATH. Exactly. His view on gender dysphoria was that it was a somatic condition, so similar to things like chronic pain. He thought that it was distress caused by the brain that we could treat with medication, but he didn't really have particularly progressive views on trans people. This is my favorite chart of horror.
Oh no.
This is the sex orientation scale that Harry Benjamin documented from his interactions with trans people. He split everyone up into six types. So you have pseudo transvestite, fetishistic transvestite, a true transvestite, non-surgical transsexual, true transsexual, and high-intensity true transsexual.
Tag yourself.
So this is the interesting thing. This is the game I like to play with this, right? So I am trans. I'm a trans woman. I am an enjoyer of estrogen. If we go by the listing on this of, like, lives as a man, dresses periodically, or part of the time dresses underneath male clothes, like, I'm a type 2. As I am today, I'm presenting here as a type 2. I'm just in jeans and t-shirt if we go by these really annoying standards of gender presentation and statistics. I'm still worthy of healthcare. I'm still worthy of any healthcare that I want and to be able to change my body in whichever way makes me feel more comfortable. Also, some very interesting stuff in here about, like, non-surgical transsexuals are often asexual. Whereas the true transsexual of high intensity really, really wants to have sex as a woman. Talks a bit about risks of self-mutilation if denied care. And that's where you can kind of see to which level they're going by this. He actually set these types out as a brief guide. It was just his observations. They were never meant to be taken as hard or fast rules. But psychiatrists are going to psychiatrist. And they decided to create this international gatekeeping rule set called the Harry Benjamin Rules. If you weren't a type 5 or higher, you didn't get access to any care at all. Then we come to the UK's version of our Dr. John Randall, born in Penarth. He is one of us, studied at the University of South Wales, and he was the lead psychiatrist at Tavistock, Charing Cross, the first GIC. He was in the documentary A Change of Sex. I don't know if anyone's seen that. I think it can still be found online places. It is horrifying. It puts an entire generation of trans people off transitioning because it documented how invasive and humiliating and demeaning the process was. He viewed his role as to breed out of our genetic inheritance those with psychopathic and adverse genetic propensities. So he was a eugenicist, and he sterilized his patients to access the care because he didn't think that transness was something that should be allowed to exist in society, even though he's there to help. He basically would dom his patients in the most fucked up and abusive way possible. They'd follow very strict demands. If they disobeyed in the slightest, they would risk losing their care. They had to admit that they were their assigned gender at birth, and that would never change even after surgery. He viewed the identity of self as a delusion, and the only way that you could access the healthcare was to let go of that delusion and believe the truth. You also had to be incredibly typically feminine. You had to be the most high femme of high femme. Skirt every day, dresses every day, wear makeup every day, and you had to be straight. Which is a lot of us denied care off the base.
Which way is straight in
that? If you were a trans woman, you had to be into men. And if you're a trans man, you have to be into women. Bisexuals, trans, gay people, trans, lesbian people, and non-binary people just don't feature into this at all. They don't get access. And these approaches kind of still get held to this day. So I'm 32. I known I was trans since I was 21. I didn't transition then because I looked up what the process was and saw that it was too humiliating and didn't access it. Then I started, then you start reading stuff like, if you don't transition before 25, then there's no point. And you just keep getting more desperate. Like I always say, the nice thing about everybody transitions when transitioning is better than not transitioning. You just need to hope that it's not because not transitioning has become so unbearable. You need to be able to do it because transitioning is a good thing and it's a positive change in your life. But doctors don't like that idea. They want to keep us away from transitioning. They don't want us to get hopped up on gender pills. If we're too happy with ourselves, then we might tell people that it's okay to be trans, and you can't have that because it's not okay to them. Gender affirming care views as a palliative. Like I said, with Harry Benjamin viewing it like a somatic disorder. So HRT is very much treated like painkillers. You dose up to the level at which people stop complaining, and then you leave it at that. There's no room to kind of explore and access. In fact, you're dissuaded from exploring, experimenting, and trying to find the right place for you. And there's lots of treatments then that are viewed as voluntary as was necessary. So things like facial feminization surgery or breast augmentation surgeries. We are denied access to those, even though there are plenty of studies that view them as a necessity for the well-being of trans women's mental health. Not just with trans healthcare, though. Like as Abby said in the talk earlier, there is a knowledge gap with GPs. This is viewed as a specialist condition that requires specialist care. It isn't. They're just not trained to know, or they don't want to be trained. They could if they wanted to. Trans patients are seen very much as a liability, so they're worried that you'll come back 10 years later and sue the pants off of them, despite the fact that that's exactly what things like informed consent are designed to mitigate against, because they tell you you're going to grow breasts, and you go, yes, that sounds very nice, thank you. And this extends way outside of trans healthcare as well, so endocrinology is a mess. So we have the wonderful drug Promarin, conjugated equine estrogen synthesized since, but it was originally extracted from pregnant mare's urine. When I said that Harry Benjamin gave estrogen to that child, it was Promarin that was given. This was used up until 10, 12 years ago. It doesn't function the same. It was never tested on people for the health risks or benefits. First time it was tested was a clinical study. This is in the late 70s, early 80s. 8,000 men they tested it on, and the study was stopped because they reported negative side effects to their mental health. I wonder why. Eventually then the National Institute for Health introduced a body to start filling out these knowledge gaps, and they decided to test HRT. So they test Premarin and Premarin plus medroxyprogesterone acetate for menopausal women. When they do this, they had to stop the studies because the health risk was so severe. But they didn't know that these health risks were there until this point. That's why we now use bioidentical hormones. So kind of looking at the knowledge gap that exists in studies, in 1990, a fifth of studies didn't include women at all. A third of them did include women, but didn't differentiate the results on how things affected them. So any differentiation in the endocrine response or body response just didn't show up in the results because everything's compiled into an average. Like I said, they like their universal solutions to be applied to everyone, no matter what. You get some strange reasons on why not to include women. Either they're saying there is no difference, so who cares? But in which case, why not include women? They also say that our pesky hormones are too interfering, that it complicates the results, which sounds like something we should know about if it messes with drug interactions or different side effects. Although they were perfect experiments in the 19th century, they were also deemed then too vulnerable after the 50s. So the women of childbearing age were put on the same list as prisoners, disabled people, mental health patients, just as we can't experiment them on because we need them to make babies. And we can't risk that, even though then the drugs could mess with that. But we're not testing that. If they were considered in studies, it was taking a bikini approach. So only testing the differences that male doctors care about, so be it breasts and reproductive organs. This kind of ignores the hormonal impact. So there's a lot of conditions that turn out to be tied to hormones, which can be noted due to symptom irregularities through cycles. This affects trans women as well because our hormones fluctuate, either weekly or daily or hourly sometimes. And so that can have an impact on us. And also when it comes to the efficacy studies on HRT, it's really just been a case of deciding how do you get the biggest boobs? And that's about it. Progesterone then is another issue as well. Most common, a controversial hormone in transgender health because we don't know what it does. We've never checked. Doctors will say there's no evidence that it helps or does anything. That's because they haven't looked. It's in the box of scary things that they must not open, and they refuse to open it and have a look and find out any answers. Because again, it might make us too happy. I'm going to run so far over. literature starts to get removed out of the DSM then in the 1980s. The symptom list shrank as new conditions kind of picked them up, and we discovered that were real conditions. Female bodies still aren't tested enough, and sex-specific presentations of symptoms continue not to be identified. So if you're a woman, your symptoms might present differently, and that would get labeled as a kind of a psychosomatic hysterical condition as opposed to how it's known to present in men. We know this from autism and ADHD. Those are places where symptoms typically present differently. Then as you take out hysteria, new diseases start to show up that don't really make much sense. These are real conditions, things like fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome. They are real symptoms that people experience. But it's just an odd diagnosis that basically stops the need to investigate any further, because you can just go, yeah, you're broken. Sorry. You don't need to do anything about it. And then you have trans broken arm syndrome, which is that if a trans person goes to a doctor for any reason whatsoever, it's blamed on the hormones, even if you broke your arm. So you've gone blind, it's the hormones, your appendix burst, it's the hormones. Started hearing voices in your head, it's the hormones. And then you have kind of tricks on how to get around it. So doctors are basically IT support, and this is how you need to deal with them. So they may not be up to date on the latest things because medicine is constantly changing. Some of them refuse to learn the new stuff. They think that the new stuff is a waste of time. And new doctors might be fresh out of university, might think, aha, I know everything. I've got all the latest data. But they're very inexperienced in how to solve these problems. They view humans as problems that need to be solved to satisfy their own egos. And they'll blame you if they fail. And they don't like it if you solve the problem for them. So conclusion then, doing your own research is based actually. A lot of this information is out there. There are medical studies that you can access for free. If you are experiencing difficult symptoms, do look online, but check your sources and find the right places. Don't just enter symptoms into stuff. Try and come up with a decent idea and start from those and start ruling things out as opposed from that. You can change a GP. You don't need to stick with them. Bring an advocate with you to appointments or an angry panda to send threatening, angry letters. And if you feel confidence and you've kind of researched enough and you know enough about endocrinology or biology, experiment on yourself. Personally, when it comes to, I went through the NHS, I got access to HRT. I have since discharged myself from the GIC and I do my hormones myself because I am more confident in my abilities than anything that the NHS did for me. They failed me at every single step and every single interaction that we went through and caused me serious physical health issues. As a result, I am only standing here and healthy because I was able to solve the problem myself. Turns out I need all three hormones. I need progesterone, estrogen, and testosterone to function. So yeah, thank you very much. 2 minutes.